Game On 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
Hello, you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock tonight, on the day that Irish cricket grabbed the nation's attention once again in a drama-filled World Cup match against the UAE. We'll have a reaction to that coming up. Ray Houghton looks ahead to Arsenal against Monaco in the Champions League. Bernard Jackman and Martin Carey on Ireland-England this weekend. We'll hear how the latest video referee trials are going on in the Netherlands, and Irish boxer Christina McMahon ahead of her world title fight in Germany this weekend. If all that wasn't enough, we have Alan Cawley in studio.
Good evening, Hugh.
Like what I did there? Smooth.
I like
smooth.
That.
Smooth. 51552 for your text at GameOn2FM on Twitter. We have a competition to tell you about to celebrate the Cheltenham Festival on the Boyle Sports mobile app. We've teamed up to give one very lucky listener the chance to win a VIP trip to the 2015 Cheltenham Festival. You and a friend treated to flights, transfers, a four-star overnight accommodation, VIP hospitality on the day, and €500 spending money as well. We've also got four tickets up for grabs every day this week for the Boyle Sports Ultimate Cheltenham Preview Night in Leopardstown next Wednesday, March the 4th. Should be a great night. Panelists including Barry Geraghty and Gordon Elliott, and the prize also includes finger food and drinks on the night. Open to over 18s only, and you can only enter by text. So the question we have tonight is: the 2014 Cheltenham Gold Cup was the 86th annual running of the race. There were 36 entries, but who won it? Text your name and the answer to 51552. Who won the Gold Cup last year at Cheltenham? Your name and your answer to 51552. Our winner tonight gets the preview tickets to Cheltenham next week, and we have a winner for the overall prize to the festival at the end of the week. Now, let's bring down the bed, because it was a pretty exciting day if you're an Irish cricket fan, which you are, Alan.
Which I am, Hugh. Yeah, they're flying the flag again, the Irish boys. Brilliant win. Well, it was a win that they were probably... It was expected that they were going to beat the United Arab Emirates.
But not in the way that it happened.
I was just about to say, but I don't think it was expected that it was going to be as tight as it was, especially after them beating the West Indies. People probably thought this was going to be really comfortable, but it was the complete opposite. But they got there in the end, and to have two wins after two matches, it puts them in a brilliant position now in the tournament, Hugh.
It does, and Phil Simmons said after the result that, you know, it's great to get the win. I wasn't overly thrilled by how they did it. Imagine for him looking on as well, you know. But for Kevin O'Brien, really, who kick-started the whole thing, he wouldn't have been too happy with the performance. But they can work on that. The important thing is that they are unbeaten.
That's exactly it, Hugh. Look, I suppose when you get to that stage in a World Cup, it doesn't matter how you get the wins once you're getting them. And they were so good. Sometimes when you beat a team like the West Indies, obviously we're one of the kind of powerhouses in the cricketing world. Mm. And when Ireland beat one of them, sometimes then you can get carried away off the back of that. Now, I thought the fact that they had a 9-day break, it might have been a bit too long in the sense that they weren't out really quick playing again. But I thought, in the sense of that, would they be complacent after beating the West Indies? I thought the 9-day break would be brilliant for them, because it's not like you're playing 2 or 3 days later and you think, like, we're only after beating West Indies, now we'll go out and play these. I thought the 9-day break, they would have been well over that and they would have been set up for today. I don't know, did that have any impact on them, the fact that they beat the West Indies and carried that in still on a high? I don't know if that played any part today whatsoever. But look, whatever about the performance, they got the win, and I suppose if you were to say to Phil Simmons at the start of the competition that you would have had 4 points after the first two games, he would have snapped your hand off.
Manchester City last night, Pellegrini was seen leaving the Etihad with his head in his hands after the result. Just a few facts for you. Barcelona had 62% possession, 686 passes, 861 touches of the ball, but as Miguel Delaney wrote today in his piece, City's three main defensive players, Vincent Kompany, Martin De Michelis and Fernando, offered how many tackles between them? How many tackles do you think? The three main defensive players between them?
97.
One.
One?
One tackle.
Actually, completed tackle.
One completed tackle. They couldn't get near them. And Kompany got that tackle.
Yeah.
That's up to stats. That is up to stats and facts from the match. That'll tell you how much Barcelona dominated this game.
Oh, Barcelona were unbelievable last night, Hugh. You know my feelings on Barcelona, and they were just absolutely, they were untouchable last night. That first half performance was as good as I've seen. But I would have to say Man City totally played into their hands, and I think Pellegrini had his head in his hands before the game even kicked off. He must have, because he must have had a blindfold on him when he was picking the team. And
well, Kenny Cunningham said last night that the formation just completely surprised him. Madness. He couldn't believe they were going toe-to-toe with Barcelona.
Tactical suicide, Hugh. Tactical suicide. To go in modern-day football, no matter who you're playing, never mind if it's Barcelona, but to go in with two players in a European fixture like that, when every team now across world football is playing with three in the midfield, And when you go in against the best team in the world, one of them, with those three that they have in the midfield, it's just tactical suicide, as I said. And in fairness to Milner and Fernando, I felt sorry for them because they were totally outplayed and overran. But they would have been against any three, never mind the best three in the world.
Yeah.
As everyone can see, 3v2, it just doesn't work. But to do it against Barcelona, and I'm surprised at Pellegrini, because I really like Pellegrini and I really want him to succeed because he seems like such a really nice fella and he's really dignified about everything. But he just got it wrong last night, he really did. And in fairness, Barcelona were unbelievable in that first half.
Ironically enough, Messi was disappointed leaving that pitch as well. You can see it on his face. If he got that penalty, the tie is over. Three goals. It's still alive now.
It would have been over. It's alive on the scoreline, but really and truly, Hugh, can you see Man City going over there?
Stranger things, Alan.
Well, they might score, but can you see Barcelona not scoring? No chance. With them three up front, and Neymar didn't kick a ball last night. Neymar was terrible. He was their weak link. He didn't play well at all. But Suarez and Messi, the midfield three, they're just so good, Barcelona.
The one player I thought that could do damage was Aguero. Every time he gets the ball, he's a nippy little player. Obviously got that goal. Took it brilliantly as well. He's so quick on his feet to get in there to steal that ball and then smash it into the net. Brilliant.
He's so dynamic in his play. That's what I love about him. And he's so sharp. He gets the ball and it's all just a touch. He gets a shot off so early. I think Aguero is the best player in the Premiership. Best forward.
Really, yeah?
Yeah, but they never have him fit for long enough. He has 17 league goals
this
season.
That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's always kind of prone to injuries. And like, whatever about playing the two, like they were two workhorses, but he played Nasri and Silva. Now, I love Silva. Silva's one of my favourites in the league. But they're not going to work back and track back. And you look at Jordi Alba and Alves, how much they were forward last night. Like wingers. Unreal they are. Like. And you have Nasri jogging back, not getting... Like, I would have loved to have seen him, fair enough, play Milner. He could have even played Milner wide right. He could have played Fernandinho, Fernando in the middle and play Silva ahead of him. Leave Dzeko out, because Dzeko's not going to drop into the midfield. Like Silva would have when they didn't have the ball. Dzeko is a big, I don't know, he's
a strong boy,
but there's a lazy element to him, Hugh. He doesn't throw himself about for the size that he is. He had a great chance in the second half, a header, headed it straight at the keeper, and that was bad just after half time. Like, that would have changed the game as well. But
that's one of the criticisms of Nasri, that why he was left out of the French squad for the World Cup, because he's just not seen as that workhorse, that energy that you need.
No, but he's not a workhorse.
Like, he's a talented player, obviously.
Oh, no, brilliant player. Technically he's brilliant and I'm a fan of Nasri. But if you're playing Barcelona, sometimes you have to sacrifice your flair players as well, Hugh. Now, maybe Pellegrini looked at it and thought, I have the flair players that can go toe-to-toe with these.
Not James Milner.
No, well, Milner's in there just working. But in fairness to Milner, he couldn't get near them. And I wouldn't blame Milner. People give out about Milner. Milner's the most...
He's not in that league, though.
No, he's not in that league, but he's the most honest professional he'll ever get. Like, it's needless stick that Milner gets, in the sense that he's a good player. He's a very good player.
He was a good player at Villa.
He's a good player at City. I'm telling you, he does well.
Yeah, he does. In fairness to him, he does. He works a lot.
He does. He's a good player, Milner. I wouldn't slate Milner. No. But they had no chance. They literally had no chance. You could have had the two best midfielders in the world against their three, and they still would have been outplayed. This is the point about playing 3v2 in that middle. No matter who's in there, if you're outnumbered 3v2, then you have Messi dropping in, it becomes 4v2. Like, they're just outnumbered totally.
So what would you do? Pack the midfield, leave Aguero up front, and hopefully he gets on the end of something?
Yeah, because if you have Aguero up front on his own, and then you had Milner maybe wide right, and he still could have played... You could have even played Nasri wide left if you wanted, once you had the three in the middle, because then you're more compact and then you get bodies up to support Aguero. But the problem with playing the two up front, it's admirable in the sense that we'll play two up front and we'll take them on. But sure, they never got the ball up to them because they never had the ball.
We're staying with football because Ray Houghton is on the line ahead of Arsenal against Monaco in the Champions League tonight. Ray, I suppose I better ask you first, did you see Man City last night?
I did indeed, yep.
What did you think of City? There's a lot of criticism for Pellegrini today in the way he set his team up.
Well, I don't think he could have won in many respects unless they actually won the game itself. He was always going to be up against it. The form that Barcelona have shown over the last few months has been extremely good. They did lose at the weekend, but this is the way Pellegrini plays. He likes to play with two strikers. He believes that's the best way to get a result. You've got to back the manager. It's got him results. He's won the league last season, so it's hard to argue against it.
Okay, look, just looking ahead to tonight, I suppose. Arsenal haven't made it past this stage in each of the last four seasons, but, you know, there's a lot of people who'd make them favourites to win this one tonight, given that they're at home and given their recent form. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen them play a few times recently, and certainly the home form is much better than the away form, and the quality of play. I seen them at the weekend against Crystal Palace, and they were very fortunate to win the game. They scored two goals and they only had two shots. So
wow.
They had 100% record as far as their goals to shots ratio. But I seen them the game before when they played Middlesbrough in the FA Cup here at the Emirates, and they were sensational. You know, how to play against a team from a lower league. Arsenal showed you exactly how to do it. Passing, movement, you know, pace on the break, on the counter-attack. Absolutely ruthless in front of goal when they had the opportunities. Could have been more, you know, in some respects. You know, but they were awesome that day. Some lovely football from them. It's going to be a lot more difficult this evening, because when you look at Monaco's recent run of results, the last six games, they've only conceded one goal. They haven't scored too many. They've only got three themselves, so they're not prolific, but they do set up to play against teams and hit them on the counter-attack. So I expect it to be a difficult night from Arsenal in that respect, to try and break them down. They're going to have to be patient, as are the home fans. You know, just going to have to wait for an opening and then try and exploit it. Maybe depending on the starting 11, of course. But when you've got Welbeck and certainly Alexis Sanchez, you've got genuine pace. Oliver Giroud, the French international player for Arsenal, should know all about the Monaco team. So yeah, I mean, I think from Arsenal they're going to have a lot of possession of the ball, but it's what you do when you've got the possession. And if they play like they did against Middlesbrough, and I know it was weaker opposition than Monaco, they should be fine tonight.
Yeah, it's set up for just a really interesting clash of styles, as you said. I mean, the defensive strength of Monaco, if you like, versus this attacking prowess by Arsenal. It's just one of those games you're dying to see which will come out on top.
Yeah, I mean, it will come down to, I would imagine, back a battle of, you know, who gets the tactics right from, you know, the two managers. I think that's going to be hugely important. Toulalan's out, he's suspended, and he's a huge loss. You know, he's a French international, just normally sits in front of the back four and, you know, does everything nice and easy, doesn't overcomplicate his game, but he's a good and a really good competitor. And it'll be interesting to see who they put in his place tonight. At the weekend, they got a 1-0 victory where they went down to 10 men and had to change things around. But, you know, they're going to have to see who's going to be the disciplined player to sit in that position. So once we get the starting 11, we'll know exactly what they're going to be about.
Berbatov is playing up front for Monaco. 34 years old now, Ray. I mean, he was never the liveliest, I suppose. But in terms of skill, he had this knack of being able to pop up and score a goal or do something to change a game.
Yeah. Definitely, and obviously coming back to play in North London will be something that he'll be really looking forward to. He had some great success with Tottenham Hotspur when he's here, and with Manchester United. I think he won a couple of league titles with United. He's an economy of effort, though. You know, that's one of the things with Berbatov. You know, he's not someone who's going to run the channels. He's not going to outpace anyone from Arsenal. But what he will do, he'll just try and be the linchpin to play the ball up to him. He's got superb control, great awareness of where the other players should be in the team. And his job really will to be give the back four of Monaco some respite, where, you know, if they've been doing a lot of defending, get the ball up to him so he can hold on to it. Then they can get higher up the field and see if they can get some players close to him.
I was just thinking as well, you know, for Arsene Wenger, if he can get his team through to the last eight of this competition after some of the trouble he's had to endure, particularly from the Arsenal fans who weren't too happy with the lack of trophies and the results that were coming in, this would be a bit of a victory for him, right?
Yeah, and obviously it's a hugely emotional game for him as well, being a former Monaco manager. You know, that's something that I'm sure he's been looking at. His preparation, I'm sure, has been absolutely spot on for this particular game. They've had, what, 3 or 4 days to prepare for it. He knows all about the Monaco players, I'm sure. He's watched many DVDs off him. I'm sure he's even been maybe out to see a match or two himself just to get a feel for what they're about. They played him in a pre-season competition here at the Emirates when Monaco beat them, but you can't take anything like that into consideration since it was just you know, a game before the start of the Premier League. But, you know, he's got some great memories, I'm sure. They gave him an opportunity to ply his trade as a manager. He moved on, and he's moved on to better things in many respects. Been here at Arsenal, got them qualified for every Champions League, you know, year in, year out, which is quite phenomenal. But the record at this stage isn't particularly good in the last 4 years. You know, they haven't qualified for the last eight. They have been up against some very strong sides, though.
Yeah.
So you can understand why they haven't got through. But they are genuine favourites. I think Arsene Wenger's came out and tried to say it's 50-50. I don't quite agree with that. I think the English league's much stronger than the French league. And at the moment, Monaco are sitting fourth in their domestic league. Arsenal, as we know, are in third at the moment. And, you know, really trying to get closer to the likes of Manchester City and Chelsea.
Okay, a fascinating battle awaits. Enjoy it, Ray. Thanks so many for your time.
Thanks.
7:45 kickoff in that one. We'll keep you up to date if there's any goals in the last 10 minutes of the show. Bill in Tremor has texted in, Alan. He says, lads, you're talking rubbish. If Barca were that good and Man City that bad, why only a goal between them?
He has a point, I suppose. Why only the goal?
That's why I said Barcelona will actually, ironically, be pretty annoyed that they didn't score more, especially missing that penalty.
Yeah, well, especially, I suppose, you on their first half performance, because they were unbelievable. They really were that good. And in fairness to City, I don't think many teams would have lived with them in that first half. But, as we said, they did play into their hands a little bit with the formation. But as you said, the 3-1 would have made it. They would have went home very happy. But still, 2-1, you'll fancy them. Like, they had 62% last night. In the new camp, they will have 70%.
Mm.
And you're telling me they won't create a half full of chances again like they did last night?
But sure, Joe Hart, Machine. Here we go again. Limerick can't sign off an epoxy 3,000 seater at the Markets Field. Sunderland put 30,000 seats in the Stadium of Light in 6 months. But don't worry, lads, we'll always have Pooling United. Comes in a text from, I take it, what is it, a disgruntled Limerick fan. It's not a great situation for them, is it?
No, it's, look, Hugh, I'm trying to be as positive as possible. As you know, the season is starting next week, the new League of Ireland season, Friday week, and here we are with a situation 9 days before the season where Limerick were supposed to move into their new stadium, Markets Field, go in with a bit of a buzz, create a big kind of bit of, I don't know, euphoria about moving into the new stadium and trying to get a few new fans on board, and we get word about a month ago that it won't be ready for the new season. So they were left homeless for the start of the season. They have 3 home games out of the first 4 in the first month of the season, and nobody knew where the games were going to be played, and it was finalised last night they're going to be played in Jackman Park where they previously played, and let's be honest, it's not the best.
Well, we're going to have a big League of Ireland preview next week. We'll let you know details on that as and when we have them. But we have to talk about the cricket, obviously, after a massive morning for Ireland and their team. They made it 2 wins from 2 in the most dramatic of games at the World Cup at the Gabba. They scraped past the UAE by 2 wickets in the end. Here is the post-match reaction from Gary Wilson, Alex Cusack, Phil Simmons and Kevin O'Brien in conversation with the BBC's Test Match Special commentator, Mr. John Kenny.
And I said to me, get out of jail card. Played it tonight.
Played it tonight, yeah. Wasn't our most accomplished performance. I think we were a bit scrappy all around, really. Balling wasn't great, and batting, we didn't really get going at all until probably Kevin and Gary played a super hand. Fantastic knocks. Probably as well as he's played for a long time. So delighted for him, and delighted for all the boys, because, you know, it was a tricky old game here. I thought UE batted really well, and you know, as I said, we did get out of jail. It wasn't our best, but it's 2 points.
We're 2 from 2, and that's all we can ask for at this stage of the game. Look, it was a bit closer than we would have liked against the UAE there, but if you'd offered us 2 from 2, no matter when we won the game at the start of the tournament, you know, we'd have snapped your hand off.
We just weathered the storm, and what we said was always to bat deep, have the wickets in hand and come home strong, which is what we did. It was great to see Kev and Willow get some runs there, some valuable runs, which was great. So.
We don't seem to want to make it easy. We let them get back into the game, but credit to all the batsmen, especially Gary, Kev, Nobby, the captain, and then Doc at the end. You know, we pulled through, and that's the fight we have. At the start of the tournament, you'd be looking, you'd be happy with two out of 2 going into the game against South Africa. So that's what we are, and we leave here tomorrow and go to Canberra in good spirits.
Phil Simmons there, sorry for the quality of the audio. It did sound like he was just about to get on a plane there, but anyway, you get the general impression. Delighted to be joined by former Ireland cricket international Andrew White. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you? Good evening.
And listen, thanks a million for talking to us. What did you make of this morning? I can't imagine it made for easy viewing as a former Ireland international to watch that.
No, it was terrible, to be quite honest. in these sorts of cases, it's far easier being involved. But no, delighted the boys got over the line. As Niall O'Brien said in his piece there, it wasn't their best performance, but World Cups is all about getting points on the board, and the guys showed true character today.
In terms of the target that was set by the UAE, 278, would that have worried Ireland initially? Was it expected that they would get as many runs as that?
It's a World Cup at the end of the day, and there's no easy games. I think the wickets in Australia are batter friendly, so you have to be prepared to chase 250 and above. And you know, we chased 300 all against the West Indies, so I always knew we had it in us. But the UAE can be tricky customers with their slow bowling, and you know. But the Gary Wilson, superb innings from him, and great to see Kevin O'Brien coming to the party there when we needed him most.
He was phenomenal. I mean, he stepped up. It was exactly what Ireland needed, and he came out, and I suppose those people were willing him to put on one of these shows that we know he can deliver on. But the pressure that he must have faced, it can't have been easy for him.
Yeah, because you know, for a long time now, he's been known as the man to deliver the big innings, and you know, the pressure he'll have been under will have been immense. But again, it takes a lot of character. This side, they never know when they're beaten, and the will to win is quite incredible to watch.
You mentioned the bowling there, the slow bowling by UAE, and early on in the batting order for Ireland, it just didn't look good. They just struggled to find the rhythm.
Yeah, and that'll frustrate the guys, because have the top four batters against the West Indies were superb, but I think in that game they enjoyed the pace on the ball. You know, you had boys like Kemar Roach bowling at 90 miles an hour plus. And obviously in Brisbane it proved more difficult there against the UAE, but you know, Gary Wilson said, two wins from two, you'd have taken it at the start, and the boys will be delighted getting on that plane to go to Canberra.
I also heard Ed Joyce say he reckons he's used up an entire year's worth of luck in one incident. That was pretty incredible what happened there.
Yeah, Ed is a lovely way of putting things at times. And you know, the ball hit the stumps and the bales went up in the air, but bizarrely landed back in their groove. And for him to be dismissed, those bales have to fall onto the ground. And he'll have looked round and had a wee cheeky smile to himself. But
have you ever seen that happen before?
I haven't seen it happen. And to be honest, at that stage, we should have known that it was going to be our day and we were going to cruise to victory.
Yeah, watching it as well, the lights came on and we thought the lights are out for Ed. He's gone.
Yeah, that's a new innovation that they've brought in Australia, where I think it's for the crowds. Perspective that they can see when the ball's at the stumps, you know, they light up and they lit up and then they went dark again with the bales still on, and that's all that mattered for Ed.
Yeah, and look, listen to Phil there as well, and I heard him this morning after the match. He said, look, delighted to get the win. It's not how I would have imagined it or how I would have wanted it, but two from two, they would have snapped your arm off at the start to have that return.
Yeah, knowing Phil the way I do, he'll be delighted with a win, but he'll be very much aware that a lot of work needs to be done in the days ahead here before we play South Africa. They'll present an even bigger challenge. They're one of the favourites of the tournament. And the guys are going to have to perform across all three disciplines, with the bat, the ball and in the field, if we're going to give them a challenge. And no doubt confidence will be high, but this is a different kettle of fish altogether come South Africa.
Okay, look, we really appreciate your time, Andrew. Thanks so many for coming on.
Pleasure.
Andrew White there. Yeah, an incredible morning. Just watching the Twitter explosion. And it's just one of the modern measures of how things are going. You log onto Twitter and you see the reaction there. It was amazing reading some of the tweets coming in from people who self-confessed jumped on the bag and went, they've no interest in cricket. You're looking at one here. No, before this, obviously, it's an amazing sporting achievement. But just incredible, the reaction from it.
You're on the bandwagon.
Oh, I am. Massively. Center stage.
and it's brilliant, you. As you know, I follow the cricket for most all levels of cricket, really. But seeing Ireland do so well, it's absolutely brilliant. And I have your tickets, Scott, for Ireland v England, May the 8th. We'll be there.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking forward to that. As Andrew was saying, they have to play South Africa next up, which will be a whole new kettle of fish. Interested to see how they react to that performance and they can improve on it. Okay, just a quick reminder of our competition. Again, one more read, because we have those tickets to give away to our preview night next Wednesday, March the 4th at Leopardstown Races. If you fancy coming along, the thoughts of Barry Geraghty, Gordon Elliott and others, and then being with a chance to win that trip to the festival with the 4-star overnight accommodation, VIP hospitality and €500 spending money. Answer this question. The 2014 Cheltenham Gold Cup was won by who? Which horse won the 2014 Cheltenham Gold Cup? So last year, your name and your answer to 51552. We'll have the winner in about 20 minutes.
Get your game face on.
Game on 2FM.
You're very welcome back. Okay, 51552 for your text. We have a few in. Does Alan Cawley think he's aiming Dunphy?
That texter has jumped the fence, baby.
Hey, lads, any chance of doing anything soon on our Invisible League, which starts Friday week? Martin the Hoop. Martin, we will, of course, be doing our League of Ireland preview. And I don't think you're going to get more coverage on the League of Ireland on any other station.
No.
Bar us over the next few months. The President's Cup as well to come. Tell us what that is.
The President's Cup is kicking off on Saturday, Hugh. It's a new innovation. It was actually brought in last year, the first game Pats played Sligo Rovers, and President Michael D. Higgins will be there as well, presents the cup afterwards. So it's a really good introduction. It's basically the equivalent of the Charity Shield in England. Mm-hmm. So the cup winners play the league winners. And as you said, it's on this Saturday up in Dundalk, Oriel Park, Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock, St. Pats versus Dundalk. And they'll be the two favourites for the league this year.
So they get a place in Europe, do you know?
Not for
winning it. No. Should do.
No.
They should.
Okay.
David Monaghan sounds like a guy who you should go for a drink with. He says, any chance of a mention of the President's Cup on Saturday? We just did. Dundalk against Pats. As the shambles of the FAI won't do anything to advertise our league. On the town. Love the show, lads.
Tell Dave I'll meet him for a pint in Oriel Park to discuss this.
Can I come too?
No. He's dead right. Like, here we are. It's what? What day is today? Wednesday.
Yeah.
9 days before the league. Have you heard a mention of the league starting next week anywhere?
Just from you.
From us, that's it.
I'm going to give you a 5 minute platform next week just to rant. And I won't even interrupt you once.
Leave me off.
Okay. Another one says, do the lights in the bales and the cameras in the stumps have a material effect on the ball hitting the stumps? Well, we were very lucky this morning. Stephen Dunmore cricket was my first. I don't know what that means.
Did you see the incident here with Ed Joyce?
Does make them heavier, apparently, Stephen. Who's been cricket was his first game since he was aged 3.
Did you see it?
What?
It was mental.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I did. No, I did. Yeah.
Never seen anything like it in my life.
Tom James says, long live the bandwagon. Great to hear a proper discussion about the game today at Game On 2FM. Thanks for that, Tom. At Game On 2FM on Twitter. We're talking rugby now ahead of Ireland, England on Sunday. But there is the small matter of a Legends match taking place in Donnybrook on Saturday. Get down if you can. Martin Curry is one of the players lined out for England. And I'm delighted to say that he joins me now. First question, Martin, I suppose, are you looking forward to this one?
It's a tough one. I look forward to the bit beforehand. Yeah. I certainly look forward to the stuff afterwards. It's the 80 minutes in the middle, which I struggle with a little bit. It's always you can tell how everyone feels when the first conversation we have with the ref is, how much time can we knock off?
Or when you're asking how much time is left after about 15 minutes.
I tell you what, that is the worst when you're blowing and you look up at the clock and there's only 5 minutes gone. You're thinking, geez. So there's a, you're telling, the good thing is as captain, you can tell a few guys to go down for tactical injuries.
Exactly.
And make sure the clock stays running.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of wondering in my head, like I was just looking back there in 2009, you retired, I suppose, officially. But have you been doing much since then to kind of keep fit at all, or has it just been gone out the window?
Look, whatever you do, there's nothing which equates to rugby fitness. So I don't play any rugby. The only rugby I play are these legend game once a year, and then that's me. So you can do, you know what, whatever you want to do in the gym. It's exactly the same when you're playing in pre-season. You can do whatever you want, but nothing equates to actually getting on the field, and there's no fitness like rugby fitness.
Yeah, we had Malcolm O'Kelly on a couple of weeks back, and he said pretty much exactly the same thing. And he also made the point, I suppose, that because, you know, you guys may have retired, I suppose, but that competitive streak is still there. So the head is telling the body to be a certain way, and if the body doesn't respond, you get a bit annoyed.
And that's the worst, you know, because there's always a good laugh beforehand, and, you know, we socialise great, and then, you know, it's the minute beforehand you think, right, come on then, and you really want to do it, and then you stand up and you run out, and it's when you're blowing, when you're running out onto the field, because it's quite a long way, you know, from the changing rooms at Donnybrook onto the field.
It is. Listen, it should be a brilliant night as well. It'll be a packed crowd there. It's always a great game. In terms of the game on Sunday, Ireland-England, there doesn't seem to be too much between the sides. How do you see this one going?
Yeah, you're dead right. And you know what? Whenever I look at these massive games, I always just have a little look at the bookies and see what the odds they're offering, because, you know, because they take all the emotion out of it and they just look purely facts. And they've got Ireland as slight favourites. The thing with this England side is, you know, you just can't call it with confidence. First of all, I apologise. I'm stood outside, so if you get any background noise, I'm sorry for that.
No problem.
I must admit, I drove down to Cardiff for the opening game, and I wasn't there with any confidence at all.
Why was
again,
that?
Because there's a lot of change in this England side, you know, and especially, you know, we've gone pretty much. We've always tried to go for in our backs with our playmaker at 12, 12 trees and Greenwood. We even tried it with Fluter. We've always tried to have that playmaker at 12 and the big guy, Tindall, Tuolangi, whoever that may be at 13. And then, you know, lots been said about our injuries. I don't put a huge amount of weight on it, albeit what it's made us do is it's made us change that centre pairing around and had the big guy in Burrell at 12 and James Joseph Jonathan Joseph at 13, you know, the slight, almost the Conrad Smith type player. And so because we had such a shift in the style of play or the personnel that you just thought, you can't call these games with confidence, because confidence only comes from consistency of results and putting this in a big over a big period of time, and we haven't done that, which always makes me always reluctant to be able to call these games. And so when you're saying how do you think this game's going to go, there's a lot which is, you say, I hope it's going to go and unfold like this, but again, I can't call it with a huge amount of confidence.
Have you been impressed by what you've seen from Stuart Lancaster over the last, not just even a few games, but I suppose the last couple of years, Martin? He seems to be quite a popular guy among the players and the fans as well in England.
Yeah, I think this Six Nations has been a real key one, and I think, you know, it's always had that shield of, look, we're a developing side. And when you're saying, look, we're a developing side, that allows you to have one or two slip-ups and just say, look, this side is progressing. But now when you look at it, it's, look, we're less than a year out from the World Cup in our home country. We've now got to be the finished article. And you really felt that for that Wales game, there was a huge amount of pressure. You know what? We haven't got any safety net here. This is all about the results. And I've been really impressed with it. You know, in terms of developing the side, it goes back to, you know, I'll go back to when he first took over in the early days, when, you know, we were playing New Zealand at Twickenham and we were leading by 15 points, and he took Owen Farrell off the fly half. You just think, now, you know, that's almost the perfect game for Owen Farrell, and he puts on Freddie Burns. Freddie Burns comes on, first thing he does, first play he makes, he throws a 20-yard pass over the top of their blitz defence, which results in a score. And I think that's the way which that the Lancaster, in giving everyone the protection of this developing side, has taken the fear out of playing, which is really important.
And one of those players who looks to have really benefited from the absence of that fear that you just spoke about is Mike Brown. And he's obviously a massive blow. The news today that he's not going to make it. I mean, he did Ireland a huge amount of damage last year in Twickenham.
Yeah, he's been, when you look at the most consistent players through the Lancaster era, it is Mike Brown, and he has been brilliant. But again, you know, especially when you look at, you know, rugby's a tough game, and you're going to get injuries, and you've got to factor in injuries. And again, that's something which Lancaster's going to be judged on, is how good his squad is. I mean, and the great thing is, with Goode, who's going to be stepping in, you know, he's an experienced international player. So it's yes, it's a blow, but in terms of who we've got to step in, you know, the result on Saturday, you know, we won't be making excuses for it was because Brown was missed.
Did you enjoy coming to Dublin, Martin, in your international days? Was it a game that you look forward to?
Absolutely. You know, I think what you have, especially at international rugby, you want to play in games which are, you know, every game, every international is meaningful, but and it's emotional. But I think it's always coming over to Ireland, there was something extra. Yes, there was the spite, but, you know, and that just made the occasion even bigger, even greater. You came over, you were treated like kings from as soon as you landed, and you just knew that come 3 o'clock on the Saturday, when invariably we used to play, you don't get those so often now, but the 3 o'clock on the Saturday, it was the whole nation would just switch against you and then hate your guts for the 80 minutes. And it was, and it made it such an occasion, you know, and it was, you know, and you look at the way the games went. You know, in my early international career, we probably, you know, it was very much with us, and then it swung to Ireland, and then, you know, and then it's coming back a little bit now. It's, you know, I think the battles have always been great, but I think from the way Ireland have played, it's always, you know, initially it was, right, stop the initial onslaught, and then you've gone halfway to beating them. Now, you know, certainly recently, and in my life, the latter stages of my lifetime, you know, it's more than that, and they developed so many different strings to the bow. It was, you know, it was a proper hard test match.
Well, look, it's been brilliant to talk to you. I wish you all the best on Saturday, at least.
I'll take that.
Yeah, it's for anyone who wants to go down. It's in Donnybrook on Saturday. It's a nice fast pitch, Martin, which will suit you down to the ground.
I've started my rain dance already.
Look, we wish you all the best. Thanks so much for talking to us, and enjoy the weekend.
Cheers. Cheers. Ta-da now.
Thanks a million. Bye. Martin Curry there, gent, I have to say. Really nice guy.
Yeah, you enjoyed that.
I did enjoy it, actually.
I don't think he'll enjoy that as much.
It leads me to one very important question, though. Bernard Jackman, why are you not playing in the Legends match on Saturday?
I'm actually in Paris for the French Wales game for co-commentating with yourself. So
yes, that's
excuse.
Right. You do have a good excuse. I got you out of jail there. Listen, just okay. We want to talk about the England game because we're live in the Viva tomorrow, and we're not going to be able to talk to you as normal on a Thursday night. As we get closer, Bernard, I'm getting more and more in a sense that England could do us on Sunday. What's your overall thoughts?
Yeah, so it's obviously a really hard game to call. I think we will win, but it's going to be incredibly tight. I think that we'll raise the performance. I don't think we've been at our best. The Italy game or the French game, our work rate and our attitude has been phenomenal. Our tactical kicking has been really good. Our kick chase. We probably just need to do a little bit more with the ball and be a little bit more accurate. And I think third game in, I think it's Sexton's second game back from. He's very, very good against. Against France, but I just think the big thing would be his relationship, will increase with Robbie and Jared Payne in terms of, that 10, 12, 13 axis. And, I think the creatively we'll be a little bit better, and that'll get us over the line. Because England are good, England, they look very, very good against Wales. Italy, they dipped in and out a little bit and probably lost a little bit of concentration at times, but I think they always knew they were going to be very comfortable beating them. And similarly for them, they'll come to Ireland, with knowing that if they beat Ireland in Dublin, they'll have had two massive scalps in this championship already and be lined up, for a real good crack at being champions.
Bernard, Alan here, how are we getting on?
Yeah, great, thanks. Great.
Bernard, I'm hearing you there saying, and the one thing for me looking out from the outside at all this is that everyone is saying that we need to be a bit more kind of expansive or creative with the ball or whatever way you want to phrase it. Is that just the case of, though, even using the soccer analogy, that Joe Schmidt is just kind of a conservative manager in the sense that he likes his teams to work hard, do all the basics, as you say, and that's how to get the results and that's what we just have to accept? Or do you think there is more scope for actually being expansive with the ball?
Yeah, no, I think there is. I think the big issue we've had is that, I suppose, we went into Italy, the Italy game, for example. I think they went in with a game plan of, let's just really build phases, let's not try take any risks. And we know that by doing that, we'll take the heat out of Italy, take the heat out of the crowd, take their energy away. In the last 20 minutes, they'll fade and then it'll open up a little bit. And I think we executed that plan, but probably for the first 60 minutes, by just been very focused on building phases. We didn't see any offloads, see any opportunity maybe to try something a little bit different. But it led to a good result away from home and a 23-point points difference. Against France, they obviously wanted to play the game away from their pack and take their power out of it. They didn't want to give them a chance to have line-out mauls, had to create a maul from line-out. So they basically kicked a lot to keep it in field. So they kicked the contest a lot. They put little short kicks in, which led to, I suppose, Spedding being able to put him into touch, and then it was our throw. So, again, there was a game plan tailored towards that. England, to be honest, are probably their back three. Okay, obviously, Barrett's probably going to come in at full-back. He's very, very safe. But they're probably not as... It's not as obvious a weakness to go to the air against them. I think Ireland still will because it's a massive strength of ours. But I think the big problem we've had in the two games is that Italy and France were able to slow down our ruck ball a little bit. And when your ruck ball isn't quick, the defence are set and it's harder to actually do things and look like you're playing a lot of attack and rugby. Basically, the next phase is generally another car crash and it looks like you don't really have any shape. But the key to the game, modern game, is quick ruck ball. And Ireland, last year in the Six Nations, you know, we had the fastest football of all the teams, 2.7 seconds on average. I'd say I don't have the exact figures, but I'm sure it's plus 3 seconds, you know, so far in over two games, and that tiny difference makes us look, I suppose, more stagnant. And that'll be the key this weekend, in making sure that we can, you know, we get positive carries, the ball presentation is good, and our first two guys just clear everything away, and that we give Murray an opportunity to sweep that ball away. And then we look a lot, I think we look a lot better in attack, because if you don't have quick ruck ball, you know, you can have all the structure and all the attacking quality in the world, but it's easier for defence. So I'm sure that's been a massive work on over the last 2 weeks.
It was interesting to listen to Martin Curry there, Bernard, say that, you know, traditionally when England come to Ireland, they expect this unbelievable storm in the first 10, 15 minutes. And if they can weather that, they know they can get a foothold in the game, start to execute their own game plan and maybe try and pick holes in Ireland. Do you expect something similar this weekend? Do you expect Ireland to come out all guns blazing in the first 10, 15 minutes? Or is it more a considered approach under Joe Schmidt?
Yeah, it's a much more considered. I think that, you know, that's taken the historical view on it. You know, I don't think you can compare, you know, what used to happen 10 years ago or 5 years ago, really, to this generation. They're changing that, you know, they're creating their own identity as such. And I think they're able to do it both ways. I think that, you know, they're able to come out of the blocks really early and try and blow away the opposition, or they know that they can feel their way into the team, into the match. I think that they're very confident they'll play till the 80th minute, and whatever plan Schmidt has, you know, they'll go out and execute that, and they won't panic if the first two or three things they try break down, because they know it's for a reason, and what they're trying to do will eventually work. So I think that, you know, Ireland's fitness levels are phenomenal. And, you know, England can stay with Ireland for 20 minutes, but that's not going to decide the game, to be honest. I think it's what happens over the course of the whole match is going to be the key. So I don't think that's really as relevant, you know. And obviously England won't want to give Ireland any momentum the first 20 minutes, but that happens every game at every level, you know.
Okay, so he's the beside then. I have to ask you, I mean, would you imagine that Joe Schmidt is considering changes? We've had people texting in wondering, would Luke Fitzgerald make it on his form over the last couple of weeks for Leinster? Would Keith Earls be an addition to the bench? There's a little bit of a confusion about why Felix Jones, as an out-and-out fullback, is on the bench when, you know, there are three or four players who can cover that position. What would you do, Bernard?
I think I'd definitely bring Luke or Earls into the bench. That's not against Felix, but I think that when he got, I suppose, in for the Italy game, on the bench, that, you know, Luke and Earlsy had different, hadn't had a run of form. I think that both have shown over the last two or three weeks that, you know, they're right up there, and which is great for Joe. And I think they do give them more options and more versatility. And that's the key when you look at a bench. Really, is particularly 5-3 split. You know, you need to get the best coverage there. So often not the best guy in one position is the guy who can give you the most flexibility. So whether Joe goes or not, maybe he's comfortable that the Felix can come in and, you know, cover those positions. But we've seen more, I suppose, for the provinces from Earlsy and Luke and international level. I think Keane Healy would probably come in. I'd imagine he'd come in to start. I think that that would give us a massive boost. And England's power defensively is obviously is going to be a worry for us, and they defend very narrow, so there is opportunities to get around them. But you know, to be able to take those opportunities, you're going to have to, I suppose, punch through them as well. And Healy just looks in incredible shape. You know, I know he hasn't a huge amount of game time, but, you know, Joe wasn't slow about throwing Johnny in after 12 weeks. John O'Brien, you know, with after a long layoff. And, you know, Keane's been able to, he's been in camp, he's had a little taste of it, off the bench for Leinster, off the bench for Ireland. So I definitely would start him, because I just think he's on his day, he's the best loose head in the world. And that's nothing against Jack. Jack's done a really good job. And then back row, obviously, he slips out. So you'd imagine that Murphy will come in there. Although there could be an argument for starting Henderson and as a six, and I suppose moving Sean to eight. But Henderson just gives such a good impact off the bench, and he covers Locke Lachlan and Backrow. So I'd imagine that he'll go with Jordy, to be honest.
Okay, brilliant stuff as always. The good news for you is that I've booked a nice romantic table for Saturday night in the Champs-Élysées, so we'll sit there and talk about the match after that. Thanks for your time, Bernard. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. See you. Bye-bye.
Bernard Jackman there, head coach at Grenoble in the top 14 and, of course, RTÉ rugby analyst. Okay, we've got a quick break to take. We're going to come back with boxing and a World Championship bid for Ireland after these.
Get your game face on.
Game on 2FM.
You're very welcome back. Now, on Saturday night in Berlin, Ireland's Christina McMahon is boxing for the WBC Women's International Bantamweight title. The current world number 9 and European number 2 takes on Ania Seka from Japan. And I'm delighted to say that Christina joins us on the line now. You're very welcome, Christina.
Hi, how are you doing?
Listen, great to talk to you. How are you feeling ahead of Saturday night? It's a world title fight. Are you nervous? Are you looking forward to it?
I'm nervous and I'm looking forward to it. All emotions attached.
Look, this is a huge night for you.
It's scheduled actually for Friday week, but I just got 2 weeks' notice.
Oh, so, right.
Awful lot has happened in the last week, to be honest with you. So they didn't give me too much time to prepare match-wise.
Okay, that's not ideal then. How do you go about doing it?
Well, Hugh, because I've been in the pro game, I would be very aware that you could be always called at the last minute. So I've kept myself in shape and I've been training all along. I've had a few letdowns, so I've been ready a few times. So this is kind of nothing new to me.
And keeping yourself in shape is nothing new either. I mean, I've just been going through your list of achievements. I mean, from kickboxing world champion right through to amateur boxer as well, and now in the professional ranks. So this is obviously something that's in you, that you're brilliant at, and something that you hope will sustain you for the next while anyway.
Yeah, it's actually 20 years this year, and
wow.
I was hoping to close the chapter, and being the ambitious person I kind of always was, I always wanted to kind of finish on a high note. Win, lose, or draw, it's like, I suppose, somebody studying for a degree and not turning up for the test and not being able to get a job after it. And I just felt I've done the work and the groundwork is there and I need to be tested.
And what kind of a test are you in for? I mean, Seki has won, I think, 26 of her professional fights, lost 3 and drawn 2.
Yeah, the records don't bother me too much, but how she performs would bother me. The record, you know, depends on who she's been fighting to get that. Like, I've had 6 fights and had to take some tough opponents to get there and to get my rankings up in a fair quick speed. So the amount of fights wouldn't bother me, although I have certainly not underestimated her at any stage. I feel that it's there for, you know, the going, and I'm not afraid of it. And funny, I don't fear losing, which is one of the things that stand to me, you know.
Yeah, I was looking through, you obviously spent a bit of time during your amateur status under Pete Taylor as well, and a serious round trip from Carrick to Bray to do that.
Yeah.
How did that experience, was it?
Well, first of all, it was worth it. I'd become world champion in the kickboxing, which I was aiming for a particular WACO world title at the time. And there's many titles out there, and I got them as well, but I wanted the WACO one. And Pete Taylor was part of that success for me because I needed to practice my boxing skills, and it's where I was introduced to amateur boxing. It was just unfortunate that after doing 2 internationals under Pete Taylor, once you hit the age of 34, at that stage you had to stop fighting. So I didn't want to go back into kickboxing, and I also couldn't stay at amateur, and I felt at the peak of my sport. And that's why I ended up going pro in the end, and it was kind of a daunting experience because, you know, the amateur boxing, you're training for 4 rounds, and I would assume I was training very hard. But when somebody tells you you have to train for 10 rounds with no head guard and lesser gloves, it's quite frightening at the time. So it was a massive challenge and a massive decision I made in my life.
Yeah, and a pretty courageous one too, I have to say. Can I ask you, unfortunately, we're just running out of time, but we might get you back in after the fight, if you don't mind. In terms of, you know, travelling over, bringing support, will you have a lot of people around you?
I actually have an awful lot of support in Carrickmacross, and even from the kickboxing background, would you believe? And the boys I trained from in Belfast are all behind me. And actually, my hairdresser today told me she booked to go over as well.
Wow.
Sarah Hannity. So my hair's going to be braided. And she's even come with me. So the small things that matter to a woman has really made my day.
Brilliant. Well, look, we wish you all the best. Obviously, you know, international bantamweight title would be unbelievable. If you manage to do it, even if you don't, we'd love to speak to you after. And very best of luck with everything, Christina.
And can I just say, if there is anybody out there that would be interested in sponsoring me to get the logo on the top, it will be on Eurosport, and I would just appreciate the help at this stage.
Absolutely. And if people want to get in touch with us, we'll put you in touch with Christina. Yeah, as you say, Eurosport showing it, so look, it'll be fantastic. Best of luck, Christina.
Thanks for your support.
No
Thanks
problem.
A million to FM. Thank
Cheers.
You.
Thank you, Christina Bye. McMahon there. We'll keep you up to date, obviously, on how she gets on. Cricket, what a start. Dreams do come true. Just look at Stephanie Roach. Have to say, Hugh, yourself and Alan are better than a tonic, even on nights when there's not a lot of sport headlines. Torval and Dean, my ass. Packy from Summerhill.
Who's Torval?
I don't know.
And
who's Dean?
No, I know who they are, but I'm saying out of us two.
I'm not Dean.
Well, I'm the man. You're the woman.
Which one is the woman? Torval.
I don't know.
Who cares? On that note,
what are you having? That's a great text.
On that confusing note, we'll leave it.